Now, today's talk is about one of the minority religions of the world, but one that has had a great effect on India, where it was born, and has spread a little bit beyond India as well. We're talking today about Jainism, J-A-I-N-I-S-M. Jainism, which comes from the Sanskrit word Jina, J-I-N-A, meaning conqueror. It's an Indian philosophy, but it's one that the Hindus look upon as being, they call it Nastika, meaning unorthodox. It's unorthodox. We'll see in a bit why some of the teaching is different from Hinduism, but basically the Hindus would judge any philosophy to be unorthodox if it doesn't accept the Vedas, the very long, that is 14 times as long as the Bible, Hindu writings that go right back to certainly 1500 years BCE. And the Jains simply do not accept the authority of the Vedas, and therefore the Hindus see them as unorthodox for that reason. Not that they say they're heretics, they wouldn't go as strong as to say that, simply unorthodox, i.e. they're not following the regular path that Hindus are called upon to follow. There are certain parallels that the Jains have with Hinduism. First of all, they would agree with Hinduism that the world around is Maya, that is an illusion, that anything that the world has to offer is going to be disappointing in the end because it will not endure and will not be therefore finally satisfying or permanently satisfying. Secondly, they also believe in the concept of karma. We shall see in a while that their view of karma is rather different from the Hindus, but they do see that in any one cycle of experience, you build up karma. And the karma you've built up determines, and this is a third thing in which they are in agreement with Hindus, the next reincarnation, the next cycle in this samsara, the wheel of existence. And also they believe, as with Hindus, that the best way to achieve their end, their goal, is by yogic meditation, by deep meditation, attempting eventually to reach samadhi or absorption, or perhaps that's not the word to use for the Jains, but certainly to reach a state in which the dualistic condition whereby I am conscious of myself and I'm conscious of a world out there is gone, and instead it's just a monistic experience, a single experience of just being one, really. So on those four points there is a similarity to Hinduism, but even on them, they have their own emphases, and I think when I outline their teaching, you'll see how very different they are, really, from their Hindu colleagues. Now, Jainism was founded, probably, because there's always a bit of mystery about the past when you're talking about India, but it was probably founded by a man whose name was Mahavira, M-A-H-A-V-I-R-A, Mahavira. Now, the Maha syllable in Sanskrit always means great or large, and Vira means a hero. So it looks as if this name is a title given to him by his followers. He lived in the 6th century BCE, his dates that are normally given are 599 to 527 BCE. So that means that he did overlap with Buddha for the later years of his life. He, like Buddha, was married, had a wife and a daughter, and like Buddha, round about the age of 30, so it seems, he became discontented with the normal life of a family man and left his wife and family and daughter to go out to seek some kind of understanding of what life was really for. And so legend has it, and obviously we're not dealing with historical facts here, but this is the account that any Jainite will give you, For 10 years, he sought the truth, as he put it, and eventually, through extreme asceticism, he did find his goal. So that is Mahavira. Now, he is looked upon by the Jains as being what they call a Tirthankara, which means, well, I'll better spell it for you, I suppose, Tirthankara, and literally it means ford crosser, one who has crossed the ford from the illusion of this life to the reality which underlies it. What that reality is, we'll come to. But he's seen as a ford crosser. Now, according to Jainite history, now I put that word in inverted commas, he was in fact the 24th ford crosser. Interestingly, the 23rd ford crosser lived 250 years before Mahavira. But his predecessor, and the person who was thought to be the 23rd, was called Parshva. Parshva's predecessor was dated 84,000 years earlier. That's the 22nd ford crosser. And the distance between each ford crosser is viewed by the Jains as being much longer than the one that followed it. So you can imagine that to go back to the first of the ford crossers means going back millions of years. Now, that doesn't fit in with our understanding of Homo sapiens being on the planet, but the Jains weren't worried about such things. What they're really saying is that their beliefs are, as the Germans would say, uralt. They go back into the dim and distant past of almost prehistory. Very, very ancient faith. Well, all we know about them is what has happened since the time of Mahavira, and that's what we're going to deal with. Now, they have a rather remarkable image of the universe. They view the universe, the whole of existence, as being in the shape of a gigantic man. And they believe that at any one point in time, during any one cycle of experience, that is, they will be at a certain point of this man's body. And according to the karma that they accumulate or don't accumulate, next time round will fix which part of this gigantic man they are located at. Now, just a word about the size of this man. It is this cosmic man is believed to be, or said to be, 14 Rajus, that's R-A-J-J-U, Rajus high. And how about this? A Raju is the distance one could travel in 6 months at a speed of 2 million miles per microsecond, and it's 14 of those. So I suppose you could say, to put it more simply, that it's the distance you'd travel in 7 years if you travelled at a speed of 2 million miles per microsecond. Of course, microsecond could be anything. It could be a tenth of a second, a hundredth of a second, a thousandth of a second. So it is left deliberately vague. It is a vivid way of saying that this cosmic man is the size of the universe, absolutely enormous. Now, the aim that Mahavira taught, the aim that one should have, is to reach this cosmic man's temple. At any point in time, you will be at a certain place in the body. The higher up the body you are, the nearer you are to this final goal, which is to be at the temple. When you attain that, then you have obtained what they call omniscience, all knowledge. Well, now let's just look at how they propose or how they suggest you actually make your way along this, up this gigantic cosmic man. They talk about two elements in a human being. One is the jiva, J-I-V-A, and the second is the a-jiva, which is obviously the opposite, A-J-I-V-A, the jiva and the a-jiva. Now, the a-jiva represents all human beings' bodily activities and bodily functions. The physical, and also, I suppose, to a certain extent, in fact, I think they would include this, the mental aspects of man, although we'll see when we come on to jiva that this might be included in that. But certainly the bodily functions, and inasmuch as you think of your mind as being part of the physical brain, that would be included. The ajiva, then, is the bodily functions. The jiva is loosely the soul, which is the spiritual side of a human being. The jiva, they believe, is immortal. Well, now you might say this, that's very similar to other religions. Plenty of religions talk about body and soul. Plato talked about the body and the soul. He talked about the body being laid aside and the soul being recharged in heaven and then returning to the earth in another body. So that image is not in any way new, is not or in any way different from the one taught by many others. The difference is this, that the jiva is seen as being the just being jiva and nothing but jiva is our ultimate destiny. That when any person reaches the temple of the cosmic man, he will be or she will be all jiva. Okay, again you might say, well, other religions talk about that in the end you've left your body and there is just your soul and that's all there is to it. We come on now to where Jainism establishes itself as, I think, being unique in the world's religions. You see, if we compare it with Christianity, Christians would say that in the end, how far you, whether you achieve heaven, depends on your soul being at one with God. Hinduism says that the moment of enlightenment is when the Atman, the Hindu word for soul or basic real self, is united with the Brahman, the creative force of the universe. Loosely God, but it's with a different implication. But nonetheless, it still is the fact that in Christianity and in Hinduism, the idea is that there is a union between the individual and the creator of the universe. Jainism is totally atheistic. There is no reference to God at all, because their view is that when you have risen to the temple of the cosmic man, when you have, in fact, achieved enlightenment as they understand it, then you possess all knowledge. You are omniscient, which is what God is supposed to be. So effectively, though they wouldn't use this phrase, they wouldn't use the phrase God at all, but effectively, one could say this, that anything that could be said about God can be said about the jiva. And that when you are there at the top of the cosmic man, at the temple, you would then spend eternity in blissful omniscience. And it is to achieve that that everything they say and everything they do is directed to achieving this position at the top of the cosmic man. Now, we begin. So we've seen immediately that there is a difference between Jainism and, for example, Hinduism, the country which gave Jainism birth. We come now to the real heart of Jainism. You see, the way they suggest that the jiva can achieve this state of bliss is by having nothing whatsoever to do with the ajiva, with the corporal aspect of our being, of our persons. The body must be totally ignored. Anything in life which the body desires, even to survive, as we shall see, anything in life that the body desires is harmful, if you satisfy that desire, is harmful to the freeing, if you like, of the jiva. It is only by ruthlessly depriving the body of everything that it wants that you will be able to allow the jiva to develop, to grow, and to eventually to achieve its final destiny. Now, before I look at some of the implications of that, let's just look. Come back to this idea of karma. I said a few minutes ago that Jainites agreed with the Hindus that we build up karma. But there's one major difference in their interpretation. Hindus will speak of bad karma, when you do bad deeds, whatever they may be, and good karma, deeds that give you better karma and mean that next time round your karmic energies, if you like, or your karmic forces have improved if you've built up good karma. For the Jains, there is no such thing as good karma. Good karma, as defined by the Hindus, means doing good deeds to people in the world. It might mean feeding the hungry, healing the sick. In other words, involved with people's bodies, involved with the physical world. And since any involvement in the physical world is harmful to the jiva, in the end, no action, and the word karma means action, no action is seen as of any help, in fact, quite the reverse. Any action is seen as a positive hindrance to the achieving of enlightenment. And this is a stance that the Jains take, which I think makes it unique among the world's religions. There is no other religion in the world which says that good deeds are harmful to your spiritual progress. I don't think there is, anyway. So, let's see how the Jains proceed with this. And I think we must be careful here to distinguish between the Jainite laymen and laywomen and Jainite monks and nuns. As with Theravada Buddhism, that is the original fundamentalist Buddhism, it is believed that it is only when you become a monk that you indicate by choosing to be a monk and to spend your time mostly in meditation that you are therefore nearing the end of your spiritual journey. For the lay people, this is seen as that they are somewhat behind. In Jainite terms, a Jainite lay person will be seen as lower down the cosmic man than a Jainite monk or nun. He or she will be viewed as being much higher, much nearer to the actual goal, and that distinction must be made. Let's leave the laymen and laywomen aside just for a moment. I'll come back to the lay Jains in a bit, but let's just see how the Jainite monks and nuns would see it. They take five vows, or they see them as five virtues. Three of them, not telling lies, not stealing, and chastity, are parallel vows that are taken in many religions, and particularly among orders of monks and nuns. So there's nothing new about that. What is different about the Jains are the other two. One of them is, and it's found also in Buddhism, ahimsa, A-H-I-M-S-A, a very, very important word. Important word in Buddhism. It means non-violence. And in Buddhism, it is taught that you cannot be a true Buddhist and involve yourself in a job that includes violence, such as being a butcher or a soldier or a hunter or a drug dealer. These are doing violence to other people and therefore are contrary to the Buddhist path. And certainly the Jains would agree on that. But they take this non-violence much, much further. Because the great Jainite principle is that one should not show any violence whatsoever to any other living being, creature, or species. Now, we'd better follow this one through, because this is how the Jains distinguish themselves, or you can tell that you see a Jain by what I'm now going to say. This is how he reveals, or she reveals herself. Non-violence, obviously, to human beings, so you would not find a Jain joining the Indian army during time of war. Okay, you would probably not find Buddhists join the army. Occasionally you might, but most Buddhists would not. So, non-violence to human beings. Non-violence to any animal. In fact, the Jains take this much, much further. Not only do they show non-violence to any animal that is in pain or is very sick, very ill, Jainite monks in particular, will spend time, as much time as is needed, to tend a sick animal. I saw some time ago in a television program about the Jains, a Jain monk who was tending a sick calf. It was a grown animal. It was a sick bull, I think. It had a gangrenous leg full of pus and matter. And this Jain monk was sitting tending the, oozing out the all the gangrene. And the animal was going to die, but the Jain was spending his time tending this sick animal. Most farmers, I suppose, throughout the world would simply kill the animal at that point because there's no hope for it surviving. But the Jain was saying, was indicating this belief that we should do no harm to any other being by tending it. And this is how the Jains are. Okay, that's animals. I think there are, again, so far, many people who would agree with that. So this is the right way to approach animals and birds and fish and reptiles. But what about insects? According to the Jains, the insect has, whatever insect it is, has just as much right to life as any other species, any other creature, and therefore they will go out of their way to avoid killing an insect. For example, in a Jainite community of monks and nuns, the jug of water will have a piece of gauze over it just to stop the odd insect drowning itself in the water. They will wear a gauze mask over their mouths when they go out, just in case they should accidentally swallow an insect as they walk along. And of course in India, the place is swarming with insects. But what about a mosquito? They sleep with a mosquito net over them. What happens if a mosquito happens to get under the mosquito net? The Jainite answer is that that mosquito, all it has done is get into the wrong place. It didn't choose to be under the mosquito net. It probably wants to get out. It's in the wrong place. So whereas I think most people hearing that high-pitched drone of a mosquito and knowing what its bite can do to you would probably clap their hands on it and exterminate it, not so the Jain. The Jain will cup it in his hands and take it outside and let it go. As they walk along in the street, there's the danger that insects may be on the pavement. So this is where you can recognize a Jain, because a Jain will have a very soft-haired brush. This is one thing they carry with them all the time when they go out. And as they walk along, they brush the path in front of them just gently, in order to remove any insect, a fly or whatever, that may be there on the pavement to avoid treading on it. Obviously, they can't avoid every time, but they do everything possible to avoid killing even an insect. All right, you may say, well, that's creatures we can see moving, but there are other living species, are there not? Indeed, there are. So we come on now to the question of what do you eat if you are a Jain? Obviously, they are vegetarians. Equally obviously, they are fruitarians. Vegans will eat fruit at its ripest. Fruitarians will only eat fruit or vegetables at the point when they're going to decay. An apple that has fallen from a tree would be seen by a fruitarian as reached the end of its natural life on the tree and is now going to rot, and therefore can be eaten because it's going to die, as it were, anyway. And the same with vegetables. So this is what distinguishes a fruitarian from a vegan. But your Jain, or the Jain monk anyway, would simply say that even an apple that has fallen from the tree is a living entity, and therefore should not be destroyed. You should not be the one who destroys it. A vegetable in the ground, even when it's gone past its prime and is beginning to decay, equally it still has life in it, and therefore that can't be eaten. So what do they eat? Well, the fact is that, of course, anything you eat is bound to be alive. In fact, what is eaten in the Jain monasteries is only grain. Grain and water is what your monk or nun in a Jainite community will live on. Grain and water. Now, you may say, well, a grain is a living thing, and of course it is. So, you may say, how then do they eat that and still say that nothing that is alive should be destroyed? The answer is that they recognize that this is a compromise, and they look to the time. Now listen to this, because this is really unique. They look to the time in any community when any one of them is ready to take the final step, which is to stop eating altogether. Again, in this program that I saw, the television cameras, I don't know how they managed it, but they managed to get into this Jain community at a time when one of their number had indicated to her colleagues in the community that she was ready to take this final step. Now, normally, this would be by an older member of the community, usually somebody who's very old indeed. This was a woman in her late 20s. I think anywhere else in the world, if a woman of that age said she was ready now to starve herself to death, her friends and colleagues would do everything in their power to dissuade her. Not so in this community. All that the older members of the community asked her were questions to ensure that she knew exactly what she had in mind, and that this was really what she did wish to do, that it wasn't just a passing whim. Having satisfied themselves about that, they then gave her their blessing, and we saw her in the film enter into a small room and close the door, where she would be left. Obviously, the cameras didn't stay any longer after that. She would be left until she was dead, and then her body taken out and cremated. Now, you may say this is pretty horrendous. And, of course, if you begin with a completely different philosophy, it will seem horrendous. But if you believe that this decision to cease eating altogether, that is itself one of the signs that the person who makes that decision has almost entered into that final state of omniscience, is in other words almost about to settle at the temple of the cosmic man, has in other words almost finished, in this case her series of life cycles. Because although she was young, their belief was that this was the final cycle after perhaps dozens or even hundreds of previous existences. If that is your fixed belief, and if at the same time you believe that in the end this is what every single experience of living has had in mind, that this is what it's been for, this is why any individual has gone through so many cycles prior to this, then you don't try and prevent it. You rejoice in somebody who has finally reached her goal, with all her burdens and anxieties finished with. Now to go to the place where she will spend eternity in, to repeat the phrase, blissful omniscience. And so, this ahimsa, non-violence, takes its ultimate form that there is no violence to anything, and if that means that your body dies, then good, good. Because anything to do with the body is ajiva and is harming your, or is a barrier. Any response to the body's needs is a barrier to your ultimate destiny. I'm not saying that I agree with this at all. I'm trying to put it so that you can see how it is that what seems to us, particularly in the Western world, but to many Hindus as well, but what seems to us rather horrendous, that this should be seen as something to be glad about. If you could see it within the context of the Jainite philosophy of life, and accept that that philosophy among the monks and nuns is believed in absolutely, then you can see that since anything to do with the body is harmful to your progress, then let the body die. If that means that your jiva is going to enter into eternal bliss, then it is something to welcome. So that is that real strong asceticism, this austerity of life, is the natural consequence of taking ahimsa, non-violence, to its nth degree. However, we're not finished yet. I've talked about the body's needs for food. What about the body's needs for clothing? At the time when the Jains first came on the scene, there were no such thing as nylon or other similar types of clothing. The only thing you could use for clothing was cotton. And cotton is a living plant. And so, among the earliest Jains, and still to this day among some, and for some centuries among the community generally, they went around naked. Because to cut down the cotton to make clothes would have meant destroying a living species. Now, clearly, this was a bit disturbing to some of the people round about, and there were some said, we must make a compromise here if we're going to exist in society. We're talking about the monks and the nuns. There are, in fact, two streams of Jainites, some who take this absolutely to its nth degree and still live naked, don't wear clothes at all. And they were known and are known as the sky-clad Jains, the sky-clad. They're clad only in the sky, with the sky. Others did make themselves very, very simple tunics, three pieces for a tunic, and they are known as the white-clad, sky-clad and white-clad. I suspect that most Jains today are among that latter group, that they are the white-clad. But there were times when, in earlier years, when in the communities they would not wear clothes. And since there is strict rules about any kind of contact between the sexes in a Jainite community, and this is absolute, the men and women are not allowed to touch each other in any way whatsoever. no touching between men and women. And the life they lived, therefore, was one of total sexual abstinence. And so we see that the fifth vow was a vow, which followed on from the fourth, a vow of total austerity. To deny themselves of the kind of things that would normally come their way is seen as a vow they've taken, and the life that is the life they live, in which none of the luxuries known or expected, anticipated in the Western world in particular, and in the East, none of these luxuries are seen of being of any help to you whatsoever. And therefore they build up, a way of looking at things that they are not seen as luxuries at all, but simply as hindrances to their ultimate destinies. The monks and nuns would spend a lot of their time in meditation. Meditation in which they seek to allow the jiva full scope, to put the body aside, as it were, and just to become pure jiva here on earth. This can't absolutely be achieved, but at least you can move towards that. To experience, in other words, to a lesser degree, but to some degree, the eternal bliss which is to be found at the temple of the cosmic man. So you're catching a glimpse of that, to a greater or a lesser extent, through meditation here on earth. And the Jainite monks and nuns would spend a great deal of time in meditation. They would go out into the community, and people look up to them. I mean, they're called tapas, T-A-P-A-S. Not yogins or gurus, but tapas. Because of this, I can only speak of this from having read about it. It seems that people who live lives of intense austerity exude considerable heat. The word tapas means heat. There's a considerable heat emerges from their bodies. It is an interesting question as to how far the depriving the body of many of its needs is an assistant towards spiritual development. There would be a lot of debate about this, and I'm sure that when you discuss this with others, this may be one issue. But it is the case that many of the great mystics, and I think that mysticism is the essential feature of religion, many of the great mystics have also lived lives of considerable austerity, where they have denied themselves most of the luxuries that other people take for granted, and that by doing so they have developed that spiritual side of their natures to an extent that they have said, at least, we can't say any more than this, they have said that they could not have developed had they followed the normal lifestyle of people around them. For them, their argument has been, this has been the way to spiritual enlightenment, this life of total austerity, of self-denial. Of course, we may like to debate that one on various grounds. We might like to ask whether self-control is not better than total self-denial. That the person who knows, however much he's enjoying what he's doing, that knows that now is the time to stop and can do so, is showing more authority over himself or over herself than somebody who doesn't start in the first place. This is a matter for debate. It is also a matter for debate as to how far the most fulfilling life is one in which there is certainly times of austerity, routine, if you like, times when nothing very exciting seems to be happening, but that it should be mixed with, so some would say, times in which you do enjoy yourself. And the real key to successful living is getting the balance between the two. It was the great German poet, playwright, scientist, and goodness knows what else, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who said, I'll quote it in German, Tages, he was describing the ideal way of life, Tages Arbeit, Abendsgäste, saure Wochen, frohe Feste, work by day, guests in the evening, nose to the grindstone during the week, weekends having a good time. That's a very loose translation, but that's what he meant. In other words, that you have the yin and the yang, which is a different concept. Well, that may be the case, and certainly it is an issue to debate. But the Jainites would have just none of this. They would simply say, the moment you start to enjoy yourself, you're fulfilling the needs of the body, and you're following, allowing ajiva to take over, and the jiva is therefore being held back or diminished. So your Jainite would have none of this. Now, I've talked about Jainite monks and nuns. You might say, what about, how come that that Jainism continues? Because if they believe in chastity and not the sexes not touching each other, then the race is going to be, the Jainites are going to be eliminated very soon. The answer is, of course, that the lay Jainites are seen and see themselves as people who are further down the body, this cosmic man, than the monks and the nuns. They do marry, they do have families, but they live according to as many of the rules that a person who's living in the community can do. They would be vegetarians, of course. Their eating would be extremely frugal, but they would not be wanting to starve themselves as the monks. That's something that's seen for somebody who has attained, or has almost attained, the final destination. Obviously, they can't be involved in any work that means killing anything, but they do enter into business, and many of the most successful businessmen in India are Jains, and they make a good deal of money. Now, what do they do with that? Because the very fact that you've got money means you're buying things which basically, one would imagine at any rate, are for the good of the ajiva, the body. Well, there are two points to make about this. That, first of all, they would give a lot of money to the poor. They would be very generous with that. But they've also put a lot of money into their temples, and although they don't believe in God, the Jains have some of the most glorious religious buildings that are seen anywhere in the world. Extremely expensive, wealthy buildings in which all the money that these hard-working Jains have earned is poured, worth a fortune, any one of them. Glorious to behold, with precious stones and everything that is wealthy poured into the temple, where quite complicated liturgy or ritual takes place, and Jains will go to it. I've not myself been to a Jain service, but I've talked to people who have, and they say it really is, if you're interested in liturgy, this is an experience that should not be missed. Well, the Jains have their liturgy, not praying to God because they don't believe there is a God, but a liturgy which is to enable the Jains in their meditation, to help them to come closer to understanding and giving scope to their jiva. That's the Jain layman. There are some Jains who live outside India, but most of them are in India, and the question of how many of them there are today is difficult to answer. All sorts of estimates, but the nearest one can find to some kind of agreement is there are about 4 million Jains in India, which sounds a lot, but it's when you think that the population of India is about 1 billion, it's only a very small, it's 0.4 of 1%. they believe that the cycles of experience over the centuries have gone in pairs, that there has been a time, there have been times over that last for many centuries of expansion. And the Jainite teaching is that in centuries gone by, there were many, many millions of Jains. And then there's times of decline, and we're just nearing the end, according to current Jain teaching, of a time of decline. That at this moment, in the 21st century, we are nearer the lowest point that it is that one could get. And therefore, they are not in the slightest degree worried about getting the fact that there aren't many people converted to Jainism. Most Jains are the children of Jain parents. And this doesn't worry them one little bit. I suppose it's, one would say, it's a convenient way of looking at it, that this is a time, we're nearing the end of a time of decline, but they are quite confident that when the cycle changes and the curve moves round in a U-turn and starts to go up instead of down, then more Jains will emerge. That's their belief. Now, this is why I say that this is a remarkable religion. You might say, well, if they don't believe in God, how can you call it a religion? I would argue that religion is not believing in God, but religion is the experience of mysticism, the development of one's inner self. And if that is the case, then the Jains stand as one of the most religious of all the world's religions. There's just one other thing I want to add, because they have produced many scholars and many philosophers. And there's one particular Jainite piece of teaching which is very prophetic of what we call postmodernism, which may sound very strange. Postmodernism says that it's basically saying that everything is relative. There are no absolutes. Everything depends on circumstances. Therefore, you can't make any absolute statement about anything. And this is what they call Syadvada. S-Y-A-D-V-A-D-A. S-Y-A-D-V-A-D-A. Which literally is, it may be teaching. It may be. Now, let's just finish by looking at this teaching, because I personally find it very fascinating. You see, in front of me at the moment is a red stool. Now, it looks red in this light, but a Jain would say, all you can say is it may be red. In the light, which is an electric light bulb, that's what it shows. But if I put the light bulb out, it would be very dark. It would look almost black. No doubt under an infrared light it might look a different colour again. It depends what light you see it under. Its shape, I suppose, if somebody were to ask what is the shape of the top of this stool, they would say it's rectangular or oblong. But from where I'm sitting it looks diamond-shaped. And if somebody sat at a different angle it would no doubt look square. And it all depends. In order to describe even as simple an object as a stool, where you're sitting and what kind of physical conditions to do with the light are obtaining at the time that you're making your description. Now, there's a very simple example of it may be. It may be diamond-shaped. If I'm sitting here, it is diamond-shaped. If I'm sitting somewhere else, it'd be a different shape. It looks to me that the two sides of the stool, the two pairs of sides, are parallel to each other. But in fact, if I sit at one point, it will look nearer V-shaped, because the part that is nearer to me will look slightly bigger than the part that is furthest away. Now, this is giving you some idea what they mean by this, it may be. And when you come on to making any kind of statement, they say, this is how it must be. You can't make an absolute. And they argue that there are seven forms of this statement. And although it may seem strange to put this into, to include this in Jainite teaching, we cannot avoid this, because there are seven forms of a statement, and I'll just give you these forms. They argue that you can either give a positive statement, a negative statement, an either positive or negative, or you can say the thing is indescribable. Now, that may sound a bit odd. Let me read out the seven statements which Jainites say are possible. They say, on the first of all, somehow a thing is. Somehow it is not. Somehow it both is and is not. That's number three. Number four, somehow it is indescribable. Number five, somehow it is and is indescribable. Number six, somehow it is not and is indescribable. And finally, number seven, somehow it is not, and is indescribable. Now, I can imagine anybody listening to this sort of throwing your hands up in despair over that, but let's go through them again and just think of a rainbow. Somehow it is. Yes, it is. You can see a rainbow in the sky. Somehow it is not. What is a rainbow? You'll never find it. You say it's there. Who's ever discovered a rainbow? Who's ever got to the end of a rainbow? Somehow it both is and is not. Well, it is in the sense that you can see it. It is not in the sense that it exists in a tangible form. Somehow it is indescribable. How would you describe a rainbow? How would you describe a colour? What would be a dictionary definition? I've talked about this stool here, of the colour red. How would you just sit down and try to write a dictionary definition of the word red, R-E-D? Then somehow it is and is indescribable. That could be true of the rainbow. Somehow it is not and is indescribable. Again, if you take my first point. And somehow it is not and is indescribable. Well, okay, you can probably see that about a rainbow, but they say the same about any moral issue, that there are no absolute moral truths. There are moral issues as they confront different individuals. And to say there is an absolute right and an absolute wrong, it's all to do with ajiva anyway, morality of that sort. But to say that there's any absolute right or wrong would be seen as quite absurd. Because what is right for one person may well be wrong for another. It may be right, for example, for one person to go to war. For another person who's a pacifist, it would be quite wrong. Who's to say which one's got it right? Depends on where you're looking at it, where your stance is, where you're coming from, what your values are that you've built up throughout life. And if we had time, we could go into this at much greater length. But this, which is really thoroughgoing relativism, it is rather remarkable that we find this emerging from a community that really began to think on these things 6 centuries BCE, at a time when all the other religions of the world, such as in the Old Testament or in the Vedas or a bit later than that in the Quran, were laying down the rules, telling what should be and what should not be, what is allowed and what is not allowed, and so on. And the Jain is just sort of throwing up his hands and saying, well, depends where you are and who you are and where you've come from, and you can't make an absolute statement. All you can say is that from where I am, and granted the path that I've taken through my life, this is what seems right to me. But at no point have you got the authority, the right, to say to somebody else, I've got it right, but you've got it wrong. Because that means that the other person is really being told the path you've come along has been the wrong path. And who has the right to say that? So, although I suspect that this talk is not going to, not that this is the aim of any of these the talks that I'm giving here, to persuade you to join any community, I hope at least that what I've said is enough to show that although they do have some extreme views on a range of issues, about which many people have not so extreme views, that they would say, well, yes, I'll go so far with you along that path, but I'm not going to go all that way, they are simply taking some of these issues to the logical conclusion. But bear in mind where it all began. It begins with the concept that the jiva is immortal, that the whole aim of all our experiences of existence, all the cycles of experience that we've had in previous incarnations and now in this one, that the aim of it all is to achieve enlightenment. And enlightenment, so far as the Jains are concerned, is that state in which the jiva is finally freed from all the wearing down of the ajiva and is free to spend eternity at the peak of this cosmic man, or the peak of the universe, if you like, in total omniscience and in total bliss. If you believe that, and you believe in the Jainite way as being the most certain way of achieving that, then you can understand why it still has many followers